This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you've ever found a tick stuck into one of the crevices of your body, maybe like your inner knee fold, for example, you know the terror that discovery can instill. But people who've had Lyme disease that they did not discover right away or treat prophylactically will tell you you're lucky if that's your experience with ticks. Today on the show, we're going to dive into the guts of the black-legged tick and find out how it actually spreads disease and what researchers are doing to learn more about these vectors and how they spread across the landscape. But first, let's get a handle on the increasing prevalence of tick-borne illness in Vermont. I'm joined by Bradley Tompkins, an epidemiologist with the Vermont Health Department. Bradley, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the three most prevalent and worrisome tick-borne illnesses that are here in Vermont right now. And why don't we start with Lyme disease?
Sure.
How many cases we have, how much it's increasing, where it's being found, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So last year in 2015, our preliminary data suggests that we had about 710 cases reported to the Vermont Department of Health. So that's probably only a snapshot of the actual cases that are out there. Not every case gets reported to us. But to give some perspective, in 2008, we only had about 404 cases reported to VDH. So there's definitely been an increase in the number of reports over the last 5 to 10 years.
And that's spread out across Vermont? You're finding cases everywhere in the state now?
Yes, we are pretty much finding them everywhere in the state. There are some pockets in the Northeast Kingdom that where it's not very common at all, but generally across Vermont, we see Lyme cases everywhere.
So Lyme is the one that gets the most press, but there are other tick-borne illnesses that you're tracking and that are pretty worrisome.
Yeah.
What are they?
Yeah. So the second most common tick-borne disease in Vermont is one that's called anaplasmosis. And that is a worrisome disease for us for two reasons. One, the case counts are on the rise. In 2008, we only had 3 cases reported to VDH. And in 2015, last year, preliminary data suggests we had about 139. So that's a pretty sharp increase. And, you know, that's due in part to increased awareness and increased testing, of course, but obviously something else is going on. And the other reason why we're so concerned about anaplasmosis is because it's a much more serious disease than Lyme disease. Of course, we don't want anyone to get Lyme or anaplasmosis, but 3% of Vermont Lyme cases are hospitalized, whereas 36% of cases of anaplasmosis in Vermont are hospitalized. So it's a much more serious illness, as I said, and it's on the rise, and that's why it's on our radar and a concern.
And then the third one is babesiosis?
Yeah, babesiosis is a little bit of a different disease. Lyme and anaplasmosis are both bacterial diseases, and babesiosis is actually a parasitic disease. The numbers for that are relatively low. We saw 9 cases last year. We've never seen more than 10. The good thing about Lyme and anaplasmosis is that they can both be treated with an antibiotic. So whichever one you might have, it's the same treatment. Babesiosis is different. It requires an antiparasitic treatment that's different than doxycycline that you might get for your Lyme or anaplasmosis.
But it is diagnosable, so you can figure out that you have it and then treat it with that.
Right. It's a different diagnostic test, but yes, you can be diagnosed with it and you can be treated effectively.
In terms of symptoms, you mentioned that anaplasmosis is often more serious in terms of requiring a hospital stay. What should people be on the lookout for? I mean, we're not going to talk about treatment today, and I invite listeners to go to our webpage, go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, if you want to see some of the work that we have done on this show about treatment methods and modalities and some disputes that are ongoing in how to treat Lyme disease. But in terms of what you should be looking at for symptoms to then decide to go to your doctor, I mean, obviously, if you find a tick, but what if you don't? What if you're just, how do you even know you have something?
Right. A lot of people who have tick-borne diseases don't find ticks on themselves. So if it's, you know, May, June, July, actually all the way through October, and you're feeling, people often use the term flu-like, but if you've got muscle aches, if you've got a fever, if you've got joint aches, if you've got a headache or chills or sweats, and you know, you've been in a Lyme or an anaplasmosis endemic area like Vermont, then, you know, you should go see your healthcare provider and you should tell them what your symptoms are, whether or not you, you know, spend time outdoors, whether it's gardening or hiking around, and they might decide to test you for one of these diseases.
And if you do find a tick, you should also go see your doctor.
So, yeah, if you find a tick on yourself and it's engorged, which means it's taken a blood meal, then, you know, you've got two options. One, you can simply wait to see if you become sick.
Remove the tick.
Yeah, of course. Remove the tick right away. And you have two options. You can wait to see if you become sick and then go see your doctor and they can treat your symptoms. Or you can go to your doctor right away as soon as you pull that engorged tick off of you. They might choose to give you what's called post-exposure prophylaxis, which would be a very short course of antibiotics that might prevent or at the very least delay the onset of symptoms.
So, Bradley Tompkins, what is the health department doing to address this issue and to work towards, you know, trying to make sure that fewer people get infected with all of these diseases we've been talking about?
Mm-hmm. So, we just had the health department's first initiated Lyme and tick-borne disease awareness month in May. So we are trying to make a bigger push for people to be aware of it. We just did a physician training in southern Vermont talking about Lyme, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis so that physicians are aware of it. And then real interestingly, there's a program that happened in Vermont last year and hopefully will be continuing in the future called Lyme Corps. And that's was a collaboration between VDH, the CDC, and some UVM medical students and some other colleagues who do tick biology. And what they did is a study that found that the recommendation used to be by CDC that if you come in from a tick environment, you should wash and then dry your clothes to kill any ticks. Well, what the researchers found is that if instead of washing and drying your clothes, a full wash cycle and then 50 minutes of drying, if you simply put your clothes directly into the dryer, don't wash them directly into the dryer, you only have to dry them for about 5 or 10 minutes, and it's extremely effective at killing ticks. So, you know, we're doing collaborations with researchers like that. Alan Giese, I think, will be on in a little bit. We work with him. Our colleagues at the Agency of Agriculture also do some tick studies. So it's that sort of research and awareness that we're trying to build within the state.
And then you also have the common sense recommendations that probably many people have heard before. Wear long pants and a long shirt. You can tuck your pants into your socks. Light-colored clothing can help because it's easier to spot ticks. What else do you recommend for people?
So that they wear an effective tick repellent. They should use something that's been registered by the EPA, something with DEET perhaps. excuse me. You can treat your clothes with permethrin. That's not something that you want to put directly on your skin, but you can put it on your clothes, and that will be effective at deterring ticks from attaching onto you. And then, as you said, when you come inside, check yourself for ticks. If you're by yourself and you can't have someone check your back, perhaps hop in the shower, throw your clothes in the dryer, and then be on the lookout for any symptoms if you do happen to pull a tick off of yourself.
I understand the health department is also concerned about other illnesses and other types of ticks that are coming into Vermont. So what should we be on the lookout for?
Sure. So we do see a number of cases each year of some other diseases like ehrlichiosis or spotted fever, rickettsial diseases. A lot of those are not indigenous, so they're from people who tend to travel outside of the state and then get sick and come back. But, you know, we do have this tick tracker website that we're also trying to push where people can go on and report that they found a tick and what type. We occasionally get reports of Lone Star ticks. That's the type of tick that's responsible for ehrlichiosis. Right now, its established distribution is kind of at the southern edge of Vermont. But honestly, we wouldn't be surprised if we find a tick here or there in the southern parts of the state.
So you should be on the lookout for all kinds of ticks that get on you, deer-legged or otherwise, black-legged or otherwise. Right,
black-legged tick, dog tick, Yeah, we don't want anyone to just leave a tick on them because they don't think it's a black-legged tick. If you find a tick on yourself, remove it and be on the lookout for symptoms.
Bradley Tompkins is an epidemiologist with the Vermont Health Department. He focuses on how prevalent tick-borne diseases are in Vermont. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We are talking about ticks, and if you have a question about these little critters with a big impact, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We aren't focusing on how tick-borne diseases are treated, but as I said, we do have links to previous shows we've done on that subject. Lots of information for you. You can go to vpr.net and click on today's Vermont Edition to find those links and to add your own thoughts, your own questions. Let's talk a little bit about how ticks actually transmit disease, how they're spreading across Vermont, and what researchers are doing on this front. Biologist Alan Giese researches tick ecology, and he joins us today from his office at Linden State College, where he's a professor of biology. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
We're also joined today by biologist Bill Landesman. He's a professor at Green Mountain College, and he joins us from our Rutland studio at PEG TV. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Jane. Hello, Alan.
Hey, Bill.
So, Bill, could you start by just giving us the basic 101 here on the life cycle of the tick?
Sure. Well, you could almost start at any point. We can start with the adult whose populations they're not as active right now. They hatch eggs, which hatch into larvae, and the larvae, as far as we know, are not infected with the Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the pathogen that causes Lyme disease. The larvae take a blood meal from, it could be almost any kind of animal. It's, we believed, about half of all bird species, most other animals as well. And after they take that blood meal, they molt and become nymphs. The nymphs are the pinhead-sized ticks that are probably the cause of most cases. And then the nymphs will search for another blood meal and then molt into adults. And that's sort of a snapshot of the entire life cycle.
And when you say the nymphs are probably the cause of most of the disease cases, is that because they tend to be the most infected or because they're so small? I mean, you can often notice an adult tick on your body, and the nymphs are going to be smaller and harder to see and spot. That's
right. The nymphs, the adults, more of the adults are infected. The infection rate can be anywhere from 40% or higher in the adults. The nymphs, at least from my numbers, about 30% are infected, but you're right, because they're so small, they're much harder to detect, and they're also more active at the time of year when people are outside. So they're believed to be the cause of most cases.
Alan, let's jump right into that here, because I know that's part of the research that you've been doing, is the prevalence of disease in the tick population in our region. What have you been finding on that?
Yeah, so I can confirm what Bill said. So we've been collecting ticks in Vermont for the past 3 years at 12 different sites spread up and down the east side and the west side of the state. And we've focused on the adults, but because we generally keep collecting until the adults stop being active in mid-June, we overlap with when the nymphs start to become active. So we have gotten quite a few nymphs, even though we've targeted adults. And it varies somewhat from site to site, anywhere from 40% up to 60% of the ticks are, of the adult ticks, test positive for Borrelia. And that also tends to be associated with density. So in the areas where we find higher densities of ticks, we also find higher infection rates. And that kind of makes sense based on the disease transmission cycle. But for nymphs, a good ballpark number is about half as many nymphs will be infected as adults proportionally. So our infection rates for nymphs vary from 20% to 30%, depending on what site we're at and what the density of ticks is overall.
And what you're finding is that's a higher rate, a higher prevalence of disease and pathogens within the ticks than what you saw when you started looking at this several years ago?
We did. The first time we went out and collected any data was in 2011, and we only had a couple sites, and we only were able to collect sufficient numbers of ticks from one site to have those tested for pathogens. And at that point, we thought the infection rate was about 11% in adult ticks. So that is only one site, so it's a little limited there. And we've changed our technology for extracting DNA and for looking for the DNA signature of the pathogen. So there's a possibility that that huge jump was a methodological change, and we've done some preliminary work, and we're starting to try to eliminate that. The early results don't point towards any methodological change. So it's entirely likely that the situation has really changed dramatically in the last 5 years. That's at least preliminarily what we're seeing.
And any thoughts on why, Bill, I'll bring you back in here too as well. Bill, any ideas of why there would be such an increase in the prevalence of disease within the tick population?
Sure. Well, you know, it's hard to know for sure in Vermont, but we can hypothesize based on what we know from other parts of the Northeast. And we do know that the tick populations are expanding, moving north. And that is something that's predicted with as our climate starts to become warmer and more northern sites become more hospitable for ticks. It's also likely that humans are playing a role. We know from research in New York State, for example, that human disturbance can have an effect on the infection rate in ticks. And that's because of when we fragment our landscape, we tend to increase the densities of the ideal reservoir host for ticks. And this is work that was done by Brian Allen's lab in New York to find that that this disturbance can increase the transmission that way.
Go on.
So beyond that, we can and those are the two big ones, and there are just a lot of hypotheses, but those are two likely possibilities.
Alan, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think to add to that, we may just have gotten to this particular site at a moment in time where the tick and the pathogen were just becoming established. And so if you think about what's necessary for this pathogen to be maintained in the environment, as Bill said, the larvae are sterile. The pathogen is not passed from mother to egg. So all the larvae come out, and the only way they become a carrier of the pathogen is they feed on a host that carries the pathogen, a reservoir host. And then if they do that as a larva, then they're positive for the rest of their life cycle. And then when they develop into a nymph and go out seeking a second blood meal, they can then pass the pathogen to a new host, a mouse or a robin, whatever it might be, that is currently negative. So for this to keep going, you have to have positive hosts in the environment, and you have to have positive ticks in the environment, and they have to keep perpetuating the cycle. So if in a 2011, when we went out and collected these ticks in the Connecticut River Valley, if we happened to get there when a tick population had just been established and most of the hosts that they were feeding on were negative because the pathogen hadn't become established yet, it may well be that in the couple years between 2011 and 2013, that cycle just had a chance to kick in and get up to speed. So one possibility is that it was just a unique moment in time that we happened to capture.
Again, we're talking about ticks today, and we're looking at the actual arachnids themselves. We're talking about how they spread around the landscape, how they spread disease around. We're going to go deep into their guts, yum, tick guts, coming up in just a moment, do a little virtual dissection. So call 1-800-639-2211 if you have a question about ticks and how this is all working in the tick population. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Alan Giese and Bill Landesman are biology professors. Alan's at Linden State, Bill's at Green Mountain College, and they both study aspects of ticks in Vermont and how they spread disease. They're helping us understand that research today, and if you have a question about ticks, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note with your question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, where you'll also find resources and links to previous shows, as well as previous shows that we've done on treatment, which we're not covering today, treatment for Lyme disease. Let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Websterville. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I had a question about my cat. He's not supposed to be outside, but he gets out occasionally. He came home one day, and after a few days, we noticed, that's actually my wife noticed, that he had a huge tick on his lip. And we removed it. It looked like a black-legged tick, not positive. But I didn't know if cats or other household domesticated animals can get sick from the ticks, if they can get Lyme disease specifically.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for the call. As a dog owner, I know that dogs can get Lyme disease, and there is a vaccine for dogs for Lyme. Alan Giese, what do you know about animals getting sick from Lyme?
I'm not sure I'll be able to add anything here, unfortunately. I know that dogs can get it, and I know that in certain cases, I think it's Labrador retrievers can get a really virulent and lethal form of it. So you definitely want to be concerned about your pet. From what I know about zoology in general, dogs and cats are really so closely related in the big scheme of things that it would be hard for me to imagine that if dogs can get it, that cats wouldn't also potentially get it. So I think there's some reason for concern. Certainly a veterinarian would be a better person to consult. So I would encourage the caller to talk to their vet and just ask them. You could maybe do it with a phone call, just ask them that simple question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill, anything to add to that?
Well, just to add that animals in general, it's when you think about whether they're infected or not, it's a tricky question because just to take an example, the white-footed mouse, which is the primary reservoir for Lyme disease, that organism, if you pick one out of the field and test it, it's going to be most likely infected. But we don't know if that mouse feels bad or not. I mean, it's not studied very well. So there's the infection, and so lots of animals can acquire the infection, and then it's a question of, you know, what type of symptoms do they show, and that's where vet would be a lot more helpful.
Yeah, and my understanding of household pets of dogs, at least, is that they can go lame. You know, that's one of the symptoms of Lyme disease. So, yeah, worth calling your vet, Michael. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. So we were talking before the break about the prevalence of disease in the tick population and how the larva, is not infected. The nymphs are infected. The adults are infected, and they can infect humans. So let's talk a little bit about how the disease is actually transmitted and why, generally speaking, people are told you've got a 24-hour window. If you go out in the woods and you find a tick 3 hours later that's attached to you, but you know it's just been attached, you probably don't have to worry. Bill, can you talk about how diseases like Lyme are actually transmitted from tick to human?
Sure. It's a really interesting process. If you start with an infected nymph, and of course not all nymphs are infected, but let's say you've got one that's infected, it takes a blood meal, and the bacteria begins to grow and divide inside the gut of that nymph. And it takes some amount of time for that bacteria to make its way to the salivary glands of the nymph and then into the host. And so after about 24 hours, the likelihood of this occurring increases, and that's why you're told you have a grace period of about 36 to 48 hours. I mean, the longer you go, the more it's just a question of probability. But this bacteria has to undergo a complex physiological change. And this is what all that time is needed for. In fact, if you took a nymph, if you were able to extract the bacteria from a nymph before it started feeding, and if you were to inject that into a mouse, let's say, which is a common way to study Lyme disease, it's very unlikely that that mouse would get an infection because the bacteria hasn't undergone that physiological change. But if you take the bacteria from a nymph that is engorged, and you inject just a few cells of those bacteria into your host, into your experimental mouse, it's very likely to get the infection.
So in other words, if I somehow could get this nymph and squeeze it right into my bloodstream, it probably isn't going to infect me. It's something having to do with that tick having my blood in its system, and that changes the bacteria?
Well, if it were a nymph that was flat, like a questing nymph, one that, you know, has just latched on to your clothing.
Yeah, like I pick it off of a leaf.
That's right. And if you try to squeeze that, and I hope you film that if you do, it's like it'd be fun to watch. But no, I don't think it would. Well, according to the research, it's highly unlikely because there's some physiological change, and it has to do with what proteins are expressed by the bacteria. And you can think of this as sort of like you might imagine that bacteria are just swimming from the gut into the salivary glands and into the host, but it's more like a maze of, or like a dungeon with tunnels and booby traps and locked doors, and that the bacteria has to get through, and that's what having that blood meal helps it to do that.
And Alan Giese, actually studying the guts of the tick is a big area of research for people who are studying ticks and tick-borne diseases. Why? What's so important to know about the tick's gut, the tick's biome?
Well, we've really started focusing on that, and we've with some of the work we're doing, we actually dissect the gut out before we proceed to extract DNA. And there are a couple reasons to do that. One is that we really want to understand what's happening in the gut, because those are the areas where we can understand how diseases get transmitted. And as you can imagine, ticks in the environment are covered with all kinds of bacteria that are just on them, just on their surface from crawling through their environment. So by dissecting the guts, we hopefully clear that hurdle of focusing on what's in the gut, and that's what's really relevant to what might get into a human. But there's another reason that we focus on the gut, and that is because when we do this kind of work, it's called metagenomics, and which means we're focusing on genomes, on DNA, but we are not discriminating DNA from a particular organism. We're just working with all of the DNA in an environmental sample. So we grind up the whole tick and just extract whatever DNA we can find. And a big challenge that we face is that when we do that, we get mostly well over 90% of what we get is tick DNA. And that's not what we're interested in. We're interested in studying the microbes. So another reason to dissect out the midgut is that we get rid of a large proportion of the tick DNA, and it allows us to focus better and get more bang for our buck in terms of the pathogens that we are able to look at and the microorganisms we're able to look at. And I'm really interested in, as tick populations move into new areas, how these microorganisms are acquired. And so I'm interested in collecting ticks from sites as far as away as Cape Cod in Connecticut, and then comparing those to sites in northern Vermont and looking at what happens when the microbial communities in a tick gut are very well established, as they have been for decades, from the southern sites, and comparing that to what's happening with that community of microorganisms in sites that are more recently established.
And Bill Landesman, how does this help anybody who, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of people now who have sort of a sheer abject terror about ticks in our region and are worried about getting Lyme disease or have, I mean, how does this research help us understand then how disease is spread or how to deal with ticks?
Right. That's a good question. What we're working on at Green Mountain College is trying to figure out, and we're limited to the Rutland area just for practical purposes of just to get to sites that are nearby. But we're trying to understand how the risk of acquiring Lyme disease varies from place to place, and especially in forest ecosystems where where ticks and their hosts are most abundant. And so we're looking at the infection rate. And similar to Alan, the microbiome of inhabiting the tick. So here are the risk factors. You have infection rate. A tick density, which is a risk factor, right? You don't want to pick up a tick. Mm-hmm. The infection rate of ticks is a second risk factor. And then the question is, what's driving variation in these risk factors? Why are some sites riskier than others? And the microbiome analysis is something that we're hoping will help us to understand why some ticks are more likely to be infected than others. There are so many organisms living inside the tick in the gut and elsewhere that it would be difficult to know at this point what all of those organisms are doing. But we can take we can get a signature, a quantitative signature of all the organisms living in a tick and comparing it to other ticks, and then we can ask ourselves, well, is there one signature of the microbiome that is associated with infected ticks and another signature that's infected with associated with uninfected ticks? And that helps with our understanding. Now, from a practical perspective for day-to-day, our day-to-day lives, knowing where ticks are most abundant, where they're most infected are helpful, and then we can understand why that is, and even try to manage our landscape in a way that might be able to improve the risk factors.
Well, and I understand that's one of the areas of research that Alan Giese is going into, managing the landscape. And Alan, we don't have time to get into it today, but I'm hopeful that we can have you back on the program because it'll be interesting to look at how do we manage the landscape to try to make sure that we are thinking about ticks and tick populations and tick-borne diseases. Biologist Bill Landesman is a professor at Green Mountain College. He joined us from our Rutland studio at PEG TV. Alan Giese researches tick ecology. He joined us from his office at Linden State College, where he's a professor of biology. Alan and Bill, thank you both so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for doing the show.
Again, listeners, if you're interested in learning more about ticks, tick biology, or treatment, we've done a lot of shows on Lyme disease and treatment and some of the controversies in treatment. You'll find it all at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition, and you'll see links to shows and research, including the tick tracker that we heard about from the health department earlier in the hour. Coming up, we visit federal reentry court in Burlington. This program allows people coming out of prison to get a year off probation if they can stay sober and complete an intense one-year program that includes court sessions every 2 weeks. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's 9 a.m. on a Wednesday. A small group of people is gathering in the chambers of U.S. Magistrate Judge John Conroy at the Federal Courthouse Building in Burlington. As they enter, each gives a deferential greeting to the judge before settling into a leather seat at the thick wooden table by the bookshelf. The people assembled for this meeting are mental health and addiction counselors, lawyers, a prosecutor and a public defender, and a federal probation officer. But they're not here to defend or convict. They're here as part of a program called Reentry Court, a program for people coming out of prison with a history of drug addiction. The aim is to get these participants, clients as they sometimes call them, onto a path to a better life.
In the criminal justice system, we see people as either witnesses or defendants.
Judge Conroy was one of the people who started this federal court program in 2009.
Here we see people as human beings, and we come to know the challenges they face with regard to housing and employment and treatment and relationships and physical health, mental health.
The program is an intense one. The human beings participating in it are all at high risk of reoffending and are high need based on their level of drug addiction prior to prison. They're assessed by specific criteria. Risk factors include age of onset of criminality, if delinquency started at 16 or under, that's a risk factor. Age of drug use, starting at 14 or under, is a risk factor. A history of violence, family history of criminal involvement or addiction, negative peer influences, prior treatment failures, and a prior felony conviction, which everyone in this case has. David Sem is a U.S. probation officer who specializes in supervising people in recovery. He's also one of the people who helped start this reentry program in Vermont.
They also have to be individuals that, should they graduate from the program, we as a system feel comfortable and have the okay to reduce their supervision. Sex offenders are excluded. People with serious mental health issues or serious histories of violence are traditionally excluded.
Because if the volunteer participants can complete the one-year program, they get 1 year off probation. That's the carrot. Before the court session begins, the group gathered in Judge Conroy's chambers talks about what's been happening in the eight participants' lives over the last 2 weeks. They talk about housing, treatment, money situations, family and social stuff, how they're doing with the writing assignments that are part of the homework of the program. One case is a participant who was suspended from the program because of a relapse a month ago. He wants to come back. And he's been clean since he got in a buprenorphine program. The team considers whether or not they should let him back in, and the judge decides he'll ask this gentleman to stay clean for another 2 weeks, and at the next court session, he'll be invited back. Another young man is in week 40 of the program, but he has a diluted urine test that they need to address. Negative for drugs, but diluted. They decide to give him a warning, but they're also going to require increased urine testing and ask him to contribute financially to the increased testing costs. Another participant has been trying to address issues in her children's school and to deal effectively with the Department for Children and Families. The team is really excited about her progress. After the preliminary meeting, everyone gathers in the federal courtroom. It's what you would imagine a courtroom to look like, sterile, sort of uninviting. But in this proceeding, the public defender and the U.S. attorney sit together at one table, not across the aisle from one another in trial-like opposition. Addiction and mental health counselors join as well, and the participants sit in the jury box, not in the defendant's chair.
Good morning, everyone.
The judge addresses one young man who's come to observe. He's out on probation for a heroin charge, and he's considering joining the program.
Should you decide to join us, you will come to realize that the goals of this program are pretty straightforward. They are as follows: that you remain sober, law-abiding, and either pursuing work or education, basic goals of life. The program itself has several components. First and foremost, one of the components is coming in here every 2 weeks or so, coming to the podium and talking to me about what's going on in your life with regard to, everything, education, housing, relationships, treatment, employment, diversions, everything that's going on in your life. Another important component is your treatment at the Howard Center. Another important component is your probation supervision with Mr. Sem. And an equally important component are the written assignments and the workbooks that you were given.
Then the judge turns to the current members of the group, all sitting together again in the jury box. He asks one young woman to come to the podium.
How are you?
Good.
A lot going on in your life.
Every day. It's not going away.
Let's start with the employment situation.
Finally got my raise.
Excellent.
So I'm excited about that.
Was it what you expected?
Yes. But I think I'm going to stick with the head of housekeeping position just because I get to interact with a lot of the other coworkers a lot more, and I also like...
The judge asks her about her hours and how the job is going. They talk about housing. She tells the judge her housing situation is better than last time. She's been advocating for herself, and her landlord is fixing stuff at her apartment. She's put off moving to another place because she and her husband had their credit scores run, and they might be able to get a loan to actually buy a place of their own.
I admire you for your ability to think in the long term. You know, you're not thinking about tomorrow alone or next week alone. You're thinking down the road. That's a wonderful thing.
I want to be able to say that I own something.
How's your health?
It goes on like this for all the participants. Sometimes Judge Conroy pushes them based on what he's learned in that pre-courtroom meeting. But a lot of what happens is support and encouragement. After the session, Howard Center clinician Christine Hayner says, sure, part of her job is to be a booster for these clients.
I'm a cheerleader of all of our participants. When they succeed, even when they're just small goals that they reach, it's like, I don't know, it's the reason I do this job, really, is to see, you know, it's the small successes that they have. But it's not all cheerleading, and that's the reality of, you know, being a clinician. There's some pretty dark times that they walk through, and we just hope that they can move forward in their lives and their recovery.
Dan Hall is another clinician at the Howard Center. While Christine Hayner runs a women's group, Hall runs a men's group. And he says these participants deserve to be commended for what they're doing when just staying sober is a huge challenge.
I think it's hard to really put into words how difficult it is if you haven't personally struggled with addiction. You know, you see people make choices and it's like, how could you make that choice? But these participants lead extraordinarily hard lives. When they can get support, sometimes it's the only support they're getting in their whole life. And so, you know, we're able to offer that in addition to all the other structure and skills that is offered.
U.S. Probation Officer David Sem says those skills and structure are a huge component of this program.
Well, I think one of the most confusing things about substance use is it, for I think the vast majority of the people, it is not the problem. It is a way in which they cope with the problem. We remove the substances and the folks are still having the same issues, whether it's past trauma, conflicts in their family, lack of employment, lack of education. Those issues don't suddenly or miraculously get better just because they're now substance free. So one of the challenges is what I've referred to as that now what stage. How do they establish a new peer group? How do they distance themselves from negative associations? How do they start to have trust in the system and the process again? And helping them through that, because when things get hard, they oftentimes revert back to what they used to do when things would get hard. And helping providing them with other tools that they can use, helping them know how to use them and know how to access them, and especially which one do I use at this point so I'm not using the wrong tool for the wrong problem.
Jennifer is a 32-year-old native Vermonter who recently graduated from the reentry court program. At the request of David Sem, her probation officer, she stops by after the court session with her infant twins to explain what she got out of the program. She'd gone to prison in the first place for selling heroin. She was also addicted. But when she came out, she said she was motivated to change her life.
It was awful in jail and awful being away from my family and my son, and I didn't want to go backwards anymore. I had hit my devastating point, and then I entered the reentry program, and that was, I want to say a hard year, but not really, actually. It was a really good program. It was really structured for me. It kept me on track. It challenged me. There was times where it was challenging around my work schedule, but I made it work, and I just kept putting one foot forward.
Getting a year off supervised probation was a major motivator, but it wasn't the only benefit, she says now.
My initial thought was a year off probation. I was thrilled about that. Then I, after a couple weeks of doing it, I started to really like it. I liked the people that were in it. I liked seeing success and failure. Failure helped motivate me more when other candidates didn't do good or didn't succeed in it. And the ones that did succeed pushed me to do better also, because I wanted to graduate the program like them and show that it works. And I know that the program held me accountable, and, you know, and it wasn't so much accountable not using drugs. It was accountable to get a job and do the structured things that you need to do every day in your life to be successful and be part of a community.
And her life now?
It's chaotic, but it's fun, full of love. I'm a hard worker now, motivated, responsible, which I never thought I'd be again. My life has joy and meaning now. There's a reason to get up. There's a reason to smile. There's a reason to do good every day. It's full of purpose. Back when I was using, there was no purpose to my life. I mean, I have goals to, you know, own my own house and work my way up to be a general manager, and just small things that I'm working towards. I mean, I've already gotten so much in the last year that I never had. I bought my first brand new car off the lot. Just little things that I never had before that I never thought were possible. I feel great about life.
Not everyone succeeds the way Jennifer has, but U.S. Attorney Eric Miller says the program is a success.
I think that the work being done by the reentry court is some of the most important and effective work being done in the federal criminal justice system in Vermont right now, particularly with respect to the opiate epidemic that we're all dealing with. From my office's point of view, we always need to remind ourselves that we work for the Department of Justice, not for the Department of Prosecution. Sometimes serving justice means prosecuting people and even putting them in jail. But if community safety is one of our highest goals, I don't think that we as prosecutors, and I would say we as a criminal justice system, are doing our job if we think that it ends when sentence is imposed. As you've seen today, so many people come out of prison with so many challenges. And if we don't give them the tools to help overcome those challenges, we do risk higher recidivism, and we're really not serving one of the highest goals, which is keeping Vermont communities safe.
Judge Conroy says the program takes a significant amount of time and energy for the lawyers, the probation office, and for the judge himself. But Conroy insists that it's worth it.
It's an extraordinary program where we see moments of high drama, great emotion, But we also see moments of extraordinary routine, the routines of life. And I'm fond of saying life is hard. And to whatever extent we can assist these participants in meeting these life challenges, it's very rewarding. It's exhausting, but it's rewarding.
Conroy says he believes this program is saving lives, one life at a time. And that does it for today's program. 200 years ago, ash from a massive volcanic eruption in Indonesia blotted out much of the light from the sun, and it led to what is now called the Year Without a Summer. On the next Vermont edition, we'll talk about that event and its devastating effects here in Vermont. Send your questions and comments to us at vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.